it seems contradictory. How is it possible to bless a couple but not a union?
That's what I'm suggesting is an invalid distinction.
Fiducia supplicans, everyone's favorite word. So we're going to talk about it. I have a feeling I know maybe some of your insights, but I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts on it. I want to start off by, first of all, acknowledging there seems to be a lot of division, a lot of confusion within the church regarding the document. What was your first reaction when you heard about the document? Did you read it right away?
I read a quick synopsis of it because I check the Vatican Bulletin very early every morning, and so I don't have a lot of time then. So I just quickly skimmed some salient points because I knew that I would probably spend most of the rest of the day with text messages and phone calls and emails asking me questions about it. And sure enough, I did.
Okay.
So I really can't say that I sat down until a couple of days later to start going over it and actually reading the content of the document itself as opposed to what I was finding online.
So after you sat down and went through it, your first impression?
As a priest of 11 and a half years, I read the document and I asked, what are they telling me I can do now that I was not allowed to or capable of doing before? That was the prevailing question going through my mind is, what is the change? Because the document makes reference to the fact that this represents a pastoral progression in the church's tradition, but it vehemently maintains that it had done nothing to change our doctrine or what we believe about marriage or what we teach about homosexuality. And so when on the one hand they're saying nothing's changed, don't panic, things are the same, it maintained that it had in fact changed something. And it was just not clear to me what that was. But then I started hearing the commentary of other people online, two different priests who I think are actually pretty diametrically opposed from each other in most things, but both of them seemed to suggest that this document was now letting them do something today what they couldn't do the day before. One saying, now I feel like I'm okay with this, now I feel like I have permission to do this, and the other saying that this was something long awaited and represented a step in the right direction. And that just puzzled me. Because if in fact, and I think you have to take a document at its word, the mm-hmm. written word is what it says it is. Mm-hmm. It does not allow for anything that would suggest you are legitimizing a union that has been entered into by a homosexual couple by way of offering them this blessing. And then they give all of these different stipulations about what makes that possible and how to make sure that we've demonstrated that fact. So it leaves me asking the question, what has actually changed? And I am left with the assumption that if, on the one hand, nothing doctrinally has changed, but something pastorally has changed, then I need to better understand what I was previously falsely under the impression that I could do that I actually wasn't allowed to do until fiducia supplicans came along and now made it possible. If it is saying that I may now pray with and offer a blessing to people who experience same-sex attraction and happen to be attracted to each other and are in some kind of ambiguous relationship, but which they are appealing to God's grace to help them to live out that relationship in keeping with the teaching of the church, which the catechism would use the phrase a disinterested friendship, that does not result in being a defined union, why would I not have done that in the past? And in fact, I have had exact encounters such as that with people who are trying to live according to the teaching of the church and finding it difficult, and they absolutely need God's grace. If I have been in the wrong until the publication of Fiducia Supplicans to pray with people who were in that situation and to offer them encouragement and to offer them support and to give them God's blessing, then I stand corrected. But I don't think that I was being very liberal or having some forbidden pastoral practice in caring for people such as that previously. If what is now being permitted is the thing that I was doing before, then obviously I was wrong. But I have a hard time believing that what I just described doing was ever wrong. But Fiducia Supplicans does not give much more of an impression that anything other than what I just described is what is allowed. Because everything else that would lean more towards seeming like you are blessing this couple as a couple who would probably not be asking for a blessing from the church or from the church's minister if they did not intend to remain the couple that they are, then there is no indication that they are seeking God's help to free them from a behavior that they do not think that they should be having. So what is being blessed then? What are they asking the blessing for? To me, the only thing that it made sense to say is that this document is saying if two people in a same-sex relationship are asking for help to break up with each other, you may give them a blessing. Because if we are not changing what the church teaches on anything that we have taught prior to this, but now something is different, I guess the only thing that's different is that you are now allowed to help people who have not yet broken off their relationship with each other to try and break off their relationship with each other. But I don't imagine that that is what the church thinks is an amazing pastoral innovation, to say that this is what is now possible. I think it is, in fact, the case that anyone who reads this document or hears about its reportage now assumes that if they are living in such a relationship with no intention of doing anything differently in that relationship, they may come and ask for a blessing. But that is not what this document seems to have extended as a new pastoral innovation. So that's why I think there's confusion.
When I read the document, there doesn't seem to be any indication that when a same-sex couple comes forward to receive a blessing, that with that, there's an encouragement to turn away from what is considered immoral in their relationship. Mm-hmm. It uses language like overcome human frailties, you know. So what are you praying for?
Right. That's what I'm perplexed by, because honestly, I have given more blessings than I can count in all of these years of ordained ministry. If a person walks up to me and says, "Father, can I have your blessing?" Depending on how much of a hurry I'm in, I may just give them a really quick blessing, or I could more than likely ask them, "Well, what are we praying for? What's the nature of this blessing?" "Oh, it's my birthday." "Oh, okay, well, let's pray for God's blessing on your life and thanksgiving for your life and for your health and for discernment of God's will." You know, whatever seems relevant associated to the reason that has prompted them to ask for a blessing in the first place. Other people, very frequently, I am asked to pray for them or offer a blessing because they're going in for surgery or they're going in for some kind of a treatment. Now, ordinarily, I can say I wouldn't necessarily ask them to tell me the details of the medical intervention that they're having. Surgery, it's always risky. It's certainly guaranteed to be uncomfortable. So let's just pray for you. Now, if that person were to inform me what their surgery was about, and in so doing, alert me to the fact that they are going in for something immoral or intrinsically evil, like procuring an abortion, right. Okay. Having a vasectomy, now we're going to have a different conversation. Because if I give you a blessing for that, even though were I unfamiliar with the circumstances, I would have prayed in general for you to be blessed before undergoing a medical procedure. Now that I know that this is the case, that is not what you need a blessing about. We need to talk. My pastoral concern now needs to go towards what will happen to your soul if you proceed with this course of action. So we could give you a blessing, great, but a blessing is not what you need right now. That's like going into the doctor's office, bleeding out of your ears and asking if you can have your hangnail removed. The doctor's going to say, that's what you're in here for? I think we have another problem. So if that's presented to me, then that's what I'm going to address. Now, the document makes reference to the fact that we should not be subjecting people to what they call an exhaustive moral examination. And so that's why I'm saying I don't normally ask people to give me all the details about what's going on with their surgery. But were I to become aware that there is something immoral associated with the surgery, blessing you before you go and do it is not what I'm going to do, and it's not what you need. We need to have a conversation. We need to talk. I need to understand where you're coming from. And maybe this person is asking for a blessing because they don't want the procedure and they're totally distressed and they are afraid of what's going to happen. What can I do to help you then? What can we do to make whatever burden is presenting itself to you because of this be alleviated? So that's why that exchange now shifts when you become aware of something else that's going on. In the case of a couple who present themselves and they are a same-sex couple and they're asking for a blessing, the document, by saying don't subject them to an exhaustive moral examination, I assume means don't ask them whether or not they are living chastely. Okay, so if I don't ask them that, fine. Am I then to assume that they are living chastely? And if so, what is the nature of them referring to themselves as a couple? What constitutes being a couple if you are friends? Friendship is a beautiful blessing in itself. I could see two people who are just friends with each other coming and asking for a blessing at the same time, but I don't think they are asking me to bless them as a couple, as an identified unit. And a unit is a unit because they are united, because of a union. Mm-hmm. So if the document is saying, we do not bless unions, we bless people, we bless individuals, then I don't understand how we can reconcile the blessing of an individual with two individuals who are asking for a blessing precisely because they have come together in some kind of a union that now makes them a couple. To create the category of blessing the couple, not their union, it seems to me that they can't be separated from each other, because if they were, then the latter would cease to be.
So the document makes clear early in the document that the church doesn't have the authority or the power to bless the unions of couples of the same sex. Then we go to paragraph 31. The title of it, I'll just read it so I don't mistake in here, is that it's titled Blessings for Couples in Irregular Situations and Couples of the Same Sex. Then goes on to explain some guidelines of how these couples should receive a blessing. So maybe you've answered this, but to be clear, like, how is it possible? It seems contradictory. How is it possible to bless a couple, but not a union?
That's what I'm suggesting is an invalid distinction. Because in making the distinction, you have to separate those two things from each other. But if one of them ceases to be because of the distinction, namely, if you say we're not blessing the union, then how does the couple remain coupled if I have to separate the union from the people asking for the blessing? If the union is off the table, then the couple breaks apart. They are not united. Or else they must be united in order to be a couple. And then you can't separate, when you're conferring your blessing, the union from those who are receiving the blessing. It's that they are united that is specifically prompting the request.
So to be clear, then you would disagree with anyone that says, no, we're not blessing the union, we're only blessing the couple. You're saying that's a contradiction.
I'm hearing people say that, but I don't understand how. So explain to me then what it is that we are doing differently now that the Vatican has made it possible for us to bless couples while maintaining that we don't bless unions. I can't understand logically, the coherence of making that distinction. That, and maybe that's my fault. If I'm just too dense to wrap my mind around that, then I accept that fact. What I find interesting is that another category of people who don't seem all that impressed by this document are LGBT activists that I'm encountering online who are meeting it with disdain and scorn and offense by saying, you think you've done something special or better for us? And they're mocking it. Mm-hmm. So I think somehow I'm in odd agreement with these people who also seem to be detecting that nothing good or valuable is being offered to them that constitutes any actual change. But like I said earlier, a priest who commented on this afterwards said that this was a step in the direction of something. In the direction of what? If we are maintaining strictly that this has nothing to do with sanctioning homosexual unions or a so-called gay marriage, then what is it a step in the direction of? And if you say of better pastoral care of people, I reject that, because we have never not been capable of blessing people. We have never not been capable of accompanying people who desire to be accompanied. I am becoming very tired of hearing the trope, Jesus came for the sinners. Jesus ate with sinners. Yes, I'm aware. Because what other option was there? To spend the rest of his life eating with our Blessed Mother only? She was the only other person free from sin. Of course he ate with sinners. There's only sinners to eat with. And if we think that, well, the Pharisees thought they weren't sinners, yes, that's their biggest sin. So when our Lord ate with the Pharisees, he was eating with sinners. When our Lord ate with the prostitutes and tax collectors, he was eating with sinners. Because being with sinners was his only option. That's the point of the incarnation. He came to walk among sinners. He does not have a preferential option for sinners above another category of people that don't exist. We are all sinners. So he has not established some special pastoral care for sinners. Because we're all sinners. That's for everyone. He came to save us all. So if we are justifying why we have to have these kinds of pastoral approaches or pastoral strategies, because in the gospel, Jesus ate with sinners, I think we're missing the point. Of course he did. But in so doing, what was the point? It was to show them that they were loved. It was to show them that they could be redeemed and that the solution to their happiness was to leave their sin behind. And that's where I think we cannot hide behind this construct of do not subject people to exhaustive moral examinations in the name of Jesus came and ate with sinners and think that we are at all participating in Jesus's ministry. His ministry to sinners was to free them from their sin, not to bless them in it or encourage them to remain in it. It was to call them out of it. Because that is mercy. That is love. It is not unloving to call people out from their sinfulness. Because we are all sinners and we all need to convert and we all need to repent. And so we really have to be careful about suggesting that somehow Jesus has something special in mind for the sinners, unlike the rest of us who don't commit that sin. I'm glad you don't commit that one. What are the ones you do commit? Well, Jesus comes to meet you there and tell you to stop.
So in your perspective, you're not sure what the purpose of the declaration is.
Exactly. Which leaves one to wonder if something that isn't said is what it's actually about. And then that opens the door to the cynicism and the attacks, or whatever you want to call them, the criticisms that are being leveled against it. For me, it doesn't make sense, and it's not worth my energy to start wielding in all my speculations about what I think this is actually about. I don't know. I can only read what it says. What it says doesn't make sense. So if it's actually about doing something else, That's really bad, and I'm sad to see something like that come from the Vatican. I can't verify that that is in fact the case. So I carry on continuing to perform my pastoral ministry, basically uninfluenced by fiducia supplicans, because as far as I can tell, it's not authorizing me to do anything different than I already could have before or would have done before.
But the document was put out for a reason.
Yes.
So you're saying, in your thinking, nothing has changed. Wonderful. But why was it put out? You don't want to speculate.
I don't think there's value to speculating because I can't verify if I'm right. This is the difficulty that we impute motive against people all the time and assume that we know why they've done what they've done. And it just sows bitterness and resentment and division in our hearts. And if we haven't learned anything yet from Pope Francis and his Vatican, it's that you can ask for clarifications until you're blue in the face and you just might not get one. The dubia cardinals are still checking their email to see if they're getting a response. And two of them are dead. So I don't think they're getting a response. But they know that you can't verify something without a response. And that was the point of issuing dubia in the first place, because you can't assume you know why something has happened the way that it has. So that's why I'm saying there's nothing to be gained by assuming we know the ulterior motives of Cardinal Fernandez or Pope Francis or whomever else in the Vatican to actually accomplish something that isn't stated. Is it possible that that is at play? Yes. Can I verify it? No. So is there anything to be gained by speculating and being angry about it and then assuming the worst? No, there isn't. Just the forfeiting of my peace. So I don't.
However, you have whole bishops' conferences saying we won't implement this. You have the entire continent of Africa now. The president of that, I can't remember the acronym. Maybe you remember it. I don't know. But they're united in this one big, more than all the conferences altogether. Mm-hmm. Have said that they will not be implementing this. And they've said that in agreement with Pope Francis and with his blessing, as well as Cardinal Fernandez. So they're seeing something that's, instead of saying, we're not going to speculate, they're just saying no.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Good for them. Seriously, I think that they are addressing the people. In a previous conversation, we talked about the audience in front of you. Know your audience. One of the things that I think is a real challenge when the Vatican tries to issue anything about anything that we believe is how can you know an audience of 1.2 billion people? So instead, you have to be broad and general, and then there may be times when that just falls flat. And I tend to believe that the issuance of this document had a pretty particular category in mind, people in mind, that they expected to be most positively influenced by this, and therefore don't think they've lost anything by the people they didn't expect to be positively influenced by it saying we're not going to have anything to do with it. So it's easy for them to say, yes, you have our blessing to disregard the thing that we just published, which in a way undermines the value of the thing in the first place. Which is why I'm not naive. It's not as though I don't believe there are other motives behind publishing this document. I can think of four or five. But because I can't verify what it actually accomplishes, although Cardinal Fernandez gets kind of close in one of the interviews, he talks about what he thinks they're managing to stave off in Germany and Austria by having published this document. I think legitimately ask the question, was this the right tool for the job? Have you accomplished what you hoped? If there is another problem here, I'm afraid that there's the potential for some passive aggression, where perhaps what actually is called for is something a lot more direct and forceful. And if that course of action isn't being taken, in addressing bishops' conferences in certain places in the world who think the church can't catch up with them fast enough, so they're going to do their own thing, you issue a universal declaration that evidently has provoked universal confusion and disagreement and discord. Have you accomplished what you hoped in holding the church together mm-hmm. by thinking that maybe without sacrificing something you know you can't, you've tried to appease some people who, if they're not appeased to some extent, are going to go off the rails? I don't know that that was accomplished, and I don't know that this is the right way to try and accomplish that truly good thing to want to accomplish, which is to preserve the unity of the church.
So let's talk about a specific example then and how you would deal with it then. So you have, let's say, two people of the same sex hear about the document. Now they approach you and say, Father, can we have a blessing? The document that Pope Francis put out says that the church is now blessing same-sex couples. You respond with what?
I would ask them, well, what are we blessing? You know, or what are we praying for? Which is, like I said, unless I'm in a big hurry and someone has asked for a blessing in general, a very normal thing to ask someone.
Right, yeah.
And if they say, well, just that we, you know, that we be faithful to each other, that we honor our vows, that we, you know, whatever they might very innocently believe that they should be having God's blessing for. If it has to do with preserving the integrity of their union, helping them grow stronger in their relationship, that is, while the document says, forbidden. So then I would have to say, well, I'm sorry, but that is not what we would be praying for. That is not what God's blessing can be extended towards. And now that opens the door to have a different kind of pastoral exchange. I have to have difficult conversations with people all the time, because it's hard to follow Jesus. That is just the truth of the gospel. That is the truth of discipleship. It's hard. And it costs us something, if not always everything. So to sugarcoat and soften the blow to someone who probably sincerely wants to be a follower of Jesus by pretending that something isn't going to be asked from them, I don't know what is to be gained from that.
So in your mind, a couple that presents themselves as a same-sex couple that are actively together as a couple, sexually, their lives are together, maybe they're civilly married, and there's no intention for them to separate when they come forward for a blessing, you're saying, well, then you can't offer a blessing to them who stand before you.
I'm saying Fiducia Supplicans has said that that is not what this document is suggesting we should be doing. Mm-hmm. So another pastoral exchange needs to take place in that moment. I heard another person in the days after this first came out use the example of saying that if they found themselves in an area devastated by a flood and a gay couple who are living in a homosexual union emerged from their house distraught and devastated because they've lost everything and everything inside is ruined, and they just saw you on the sidewalk as a priest, and so they asked for your blessing, that now he thinks he would be able to do that, whereas before he would have been unsure and uncomfortable. And I just could not understand the point he was trying to make, because I do not believe that these people who have just experienced a tragedy, irrespective of whatever manner of sinfulness they happen to be living in, because guess what? Everyone else on that block is also sinful in some capacity or another. What's burdening them is the fact that they've just lost their possessions, that they are about to be homeless, that they are devastated. If that's clearly what they're asking you to pray with them about, that's what they're asking for your blessing, is to help them persevere through the challenge that faces them now. Fiducia Supplicans is not making it possible for me to bless them now, because you may now bless homosexual couples who are suffering. We have always been able to bless people who are suffering if what they're asking for is help with bearing their suffering. And so that's why I'm saying a novelty has not been introduced here. That is just basic good pastoral care. That has always been what we would have provided. But if someone thinks that now they have the right or the permission to ask for the blessing that is to help them persevere in or live better or more faithfully their union, Fiducia Supplicans has not said that that is what is now allowed, and that is what precisely the Church has maintained we can't do in the first place.
You said earlier that the text needs to be read as it is stated. The text does say a new novelty has been introduced. But I'm going to point to something you just said, that you said nothing new has happened. So shouldn't we look at the text and say, well, something new has happened, and try and figure out what is that new thing?
Yes, and I think Cardinal Fernandez is also still trying to get to the bottom of this new thing he has introduced, because he also says that there is no need for any further comment or clarification, that this document speaks for itself, and so don't expect to hear anything else about this. And then he gave a very long interview the very next day, and then within 3 days had issued a 5-page press release that was half the length of the original document in question. He hasn't stopped trying to explain and clarify and respond since it was published. So that there is confusion is not my uncharitable criticism or accusation against them. He is manifesting that there is clearly confusion. And those who say, I can't believe anyone is confused about this. Well, I can't believe you're not, because the cardinal who authored it seems to be confused as he struggles to try and find ways to make people understand what's going on here. So do not pretend that there isn't confusion here and that it is perfectly understandable and that no questions need to be asked. It clearly isn't, or else the cardinal would not be trying to try and make it clearer. In part of his follow-up explanations and clarifications, he uses an example of a couple who present themselves as a couple, but who tell you not that they're a homosexual couple. It says that they're in an irregular union. It doesn't specify what kind or nature, but it says, you know, he kind of gives a litany of misfortune here. Like, well, we're recently homeless and now sick and need medical care and starving, and we're just hoping for God's blessing. And so he says, maybe you would say a prayer of something like this. And he gives an example of a prayer. I can't remember how to quote it, but it says, Lord, look upon these your servants who, despite their frailties, struggle to serve you. Give them proper clothing and food and housing and health. We ask this through Christ our Lord. And then make the sign of the cross over them. As I read that, I thought, okay, this little formula you've just prepared, is this an example of the novelty that you believe you have provided the Church through Fiducia Supplicans? Someone comes to tell me that they're homeless and starving and sick and are asking for a blessing. I was aware prior to Fiducia Supplicans that I could extend my hands over them.
Finally, I can bless you.
And say, Lord, please send this person food and shelter and health. So that's why the example only further obfuscates the point. Because if you're struggling to help me see what's new, and then you use an example of something that has routinely, universally already been happening, then I don't see the novelty. And then the cynical thing is to say, well, the novelty is in what it doesn't say. But that's my point. We can't read a document and judge it based upon what it doesn't say. We can criticize what we are afraid will be the consequence of it not saying this. And I think that may be part of what we're seeing happen with the African bishops, saying, we can't implement this because we think it means something other than you're saying, so we're just not going to do it. That is basically their reaction. I'm probably oversimplifying it, but I think it's clear why people are having that reaction. And Father James Martin, I'm not calling him out on purpose, but he was one of the main spokesmen for why this constituted what he called this step in a new direction, seemed to suggest the next day after this was published by having photographs of him published in the New York Times, mm-hmm. conferring one of these blessings. It does not seem to me that you could have had that be spontaneous and private, where it does not appear to be a blessing conferred upon the couple as a couple united. I mean, the couple in question were standing hand in hand. It would look like, unless I've misunderstood the document, a basic violation of what the document says is now permitted. But I don't believe he's been reprimanded or punished or issued a correction or indicated that he didn't live up to the spirit of the document properly. And that being let go begins to establish some of what I think leads to people saying, well, maybe there's something unspoken that's actually intended behind this document. If when it gets violated or contradicted, that is left unpunished.
Well, it starts creating a narrative. I mean, I know that you said you don't want to assume what is not been said, like the unspoken thing. But you have this, I'm not so sure about that. Like, I mean, you have that example where he is, no, I'm not saying that he did everything in accordance with the document. I'm not saying that. It seems to be, without knowing all those details, it seems at the very least to be a violation when you have two men holding hands together and he's got his hands forward like that. Like, but he also has, you know, some sort of office and communications with the Vatican. He's met privately with Pope Francis a number of times. He's got a letter of support from Pope Francis for his ministry. All of this, doesn't it communicate something?
Yes, it does seem to. And that's why I say it exactly like that. It does seem to. But what? And if it's that, well, the Pope is clearly endorsing X, Y, or Z. Well, no, he's not clearly endorsing it. Mm-hmm. It's worse. He's ambiguously leaving things up in the air that don't get resolved. And that may only just be the consequence of, you know, very basically, he's just busy. Too busy to deal with stomping out every fire that seems to have been started by accidentally causing some confusion. But we're becoming, I think, very familiar with this dynamic that results in a variety of different kinds of confusion, and they're just left alone. Just there, sort of floating in the ether. And that's partly why the angle I've taken is to say, doesn't concern me. I am busy. I have a lot on my plate in my pastoral ministry, and souls entrusted to my care, and deadlines to meet for things that my bishop has asked. I don't have time to just endlessly sit and wonder when the Pope is going to clarify something that he's confused me about. Perhaps I wouldn't be confused if I wasn't paying attention. And maybe that's part of the problem. It's too easy to pay too much attention.
If the church really wants to reach out to the LGBTQ community or a couple that's in a same-sex relationship, I just don't see how this document really does that effectively. Mm-hmm. You said, you know, you tend to agree with some of those who have been criticizing the document, activists. I would agree. It's sort of condescending in a way. It's like, come, let's have a blessing, a quick blessing, no more than a couple seconds. Make sure no one sees, and gestures that don't resemble at all marriage. Like, and let's be sure no photographers are around or anything. to reach out to a couple that say come into the church. It just doesn't seem like that's a very effective way. Mm-hmm. Am I missing something on this?
No, I don't disagree with you at all. I think it, if that is the stated intention, mm-hmm. is to try and make people feel more welcome or to show the face of a more inclusive church, I don't think that has been accomplished. And that's, again, going to this point of trying to find an explanation or give some interpretation to why something has happened the way that it has. And what does this actually mean? And as soon as we put that qualifying word on, what does this actually mean? We are implying that there is something not being communicated that is more in keeping with the essence of the purpose of this thing. And we are not going to get a clear answer to that question.
A couple of weeks ago, I don't know if you saw our video, we had a quick little, Janelle and I did a mm-hmm. little commentary outside.
On your porch.
So you did see that?
I did.
So in that video, I said it was a pastoral disaster. Mm-hmm. And then I also, which I don't see how you can see it another way. I don't want to be disrespectful, but I mean, just like the great, I mean, you're talking about you're having trouble understanding what that new thing is. That seems to be not the greatest thing for the church. But I brought up the situation as me as a father of seven children, and should one of my children ever experience same-sex attraction, the best thing for them, if they approach a priest with their partner, would be to have a conversation about their attractions, the nature of love, who God is. But I wouldn't want them to have a conversation with a priest that in any way affirms their relationship and any immoral activity that's happening within their relationship. Mm-hmm. And my concern when first reading that the document was that door is opened in some way for a priest to give a blessing without counseling them to turn away from immorality. Mm-hmm. Do you think my concern is valid or not?
Absolutely. I do believe that that is more than a valid concern. It's a likely outcome. I'm willing to concede that the document as it is, verbatim, without any additional interpretation, at the very least seems to have opened the door slightly ajar to something different than has been the case until now. The document itself claims that it has done so. I say it's not clear to me what that actually is. But it will become clearer what that is. The more instances we see of additional violations of it being executed the way that it claims it's meant to be executed, that go unpunished or uncorrected. And then what happens as a consequence will become seen as normative or the standard or what this was really for. We've been living in this for 60 years. The whole concept of the spirit of Vatican II. Well, we know what the document says, but what does it mean? And here again, we have one of these false distinctions. This is a false dichotomy. It means what it says. So when a document says Gregorian chant will hold pride of place in the sacred liturgy, well, that's what it means. That nothing is superior to Gregorian chant in the liturgy. You can't read that document from the Second Vatican Council and then say, but what do they mean? I think what they mean is that Gregorian chant is nice, but it doesn't mean we can't have the polka mass, which I grew up seeing celebrated in my hometown. So that's where we continuously run into this perennial problem of deciding that this thing means more than it says and that it is open to additional interpretation than simply reading the text and striving to live it, striving to implement it. And it just goes back to the point I've been trying to make this whole conversation. If I read that text with a fine-tooth comb, then there is nothing about it that I would do any differently and how I have carried on my pastoral ministry, before Fiducia Supplicans and now afterwards. But if, in fact, it is intended that something is new and different, and then the next step is people start introducing all sorts of innovations in the name of Fiducia Supplicans that would look like violations of what's clearly written down, those will become the new standard. Those aberrations become normative. And that's what we, now many are willing to admit and acknowledge 60 years out, that a lot of what we face right now in the life of the church with regard to the implementation of the Second Vatican Council's documents has been subject to that dynamic, where what people decided they wanted the document to mean is what was implemented, not studying the texts and striving to implement them. And we're walking into another room of the exact same furnishing with Fiducia Supplicans.